the arms of the chair. He set his face in what he tried to make an easy, interested smile and waited.
"It's about the baggage handlers at the airport," Pata said.
Brunetti applied psychic Botox to his smile and nodded while turning his attention to Sant'Antonio, patron saint of lost things and lost causes.
"Dear Sant'Antonio, lift this weight from my shoulders, and I shall give you my gratitude and thanks forever and ever. Amen."
His mother had taught him, when he was still a boy, that it was vulgar and offensive to try to bargain with the saints, to offer them prayers or good works in exchange for favors.
"Just tell them you will thank them and be grateful to them," she had told him, and then explained, "After all, they're in heaven. Could they want anything more?"
This, even to a child, had seemed eminently sensible, and he had never wavered from her teaching. Brunetti thus had a number of saints he more or less kept on call, invoking their aid when in need of it, always grateful to them for their help and vociferous in giving them his thanks.
"Ah, yes, the baggage handlers," Brunetti said, as though he found the topic mildly interesting. "It's been years that we've been playing cat and mouse with them," Pata began.
Brunetti nodded. He'd spent days, weeks, months investigating them, overseeing the planting of micro-cameras in various parts of the airport, arresting them, taking them in for questioning, confronting them with the videos of their pilfering of the suitcases entrusted to their care. And was one of them in prison? Had one of them ever been fired?
"And I'm tired of it."
Pata, who had occasionally had to approve the attempts to gather conclusive evidence against them, said wearily. As were they all, Brunetti longed to say. Instead, he adjusted his face to display curiosity. Pata either did not register or chose to ignore his expression, so Brunetti asked,
"And so, Vice Questore?" "We've wasted enough time on this, and I've decided to put an end to it," Pata said in his most authoritarian voice.
Brunetti was curious about how the Vice Questore planned to accomplish this. Forbid them entry to the airport? Arrest them all? Build a wall?
"The airport is not in Venice," Pata declared. "It is in Tessera," he added.
Then, making it evident that he was irritated by incompetence, but not such a bad sport that he would make an issue of it, he added,
"No one seems to have noticed that before I did."
He paused to allow Brunetti to become aware of his own partial responsibility for this legal oversight, and then continued,
"I spoke with the city's lawyers today and told them that because Tessera is a part of Mestre and not of Venice, it is therefore within their jurisdiction, not ours, and thus the police of Mestre are responsible for law enforcement at the airport, and we are not."
"What answer did they give you, Signore?"
"They will look into the legal background of the matter, but until then,"
Pata said, and deliberately teasing, let his voice drift off and made an airily dismissive gesture with his hand.
"Until then, sir?"
Brunetti, who could not bear the suspense, inquired.
"Until then, there will be no police interference with or surveillance of the baggage handlers,"
Pata said, as if he'd arranged the arrest of the entire leadership of the Sacra Corona Unita, and farther attention was redundant.
"None at all?" Brunetti asked.
"None. I've ordered our patrols there stopped, and informed my colleagues in Mestre of this fact."
He aimed a smile at Brunetti and said,
"I wanted you to know this so that you will not question the new schedules." "And your colleague in Mestre, Vice Questore?"
Another smile radiated out from Pata's face.
"He's refused to assume any responsibility and will not order his men to patrol."
Brunetti, thinking of his conversation with Grifoni about the complicity of the pharmacists who remained silent, said,
That was a very wise decision, dottore.
He smiled and asked, "Will that be all, signore?" At Pata's nod, he got to his feet and left the office. Signorina Elettra glanced at him as he emerged into her office. Brunetti studied her face and saw in it traces of its usual warmth, noticed as well that the dark flowers had been exiled to the windowsill.
"The Vice Questore has told me that there will be no more investigations of the baggage handlers."
"Yes,"
she said, all but glowing.
"I know."
Well, 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 Brunetti thought. Signorina Elettra was much given to elliptical remarks, and so ordinarily he would have thought she meant that gossip had wafted this news towards her. But there was nothing in her remark but granite hard fact. She had heard because of the listening device she had planted in Pata's office.
"You seem pleased," Brunetti said, "if I might observe."
"Oh, I am pleased. Very,"
she said, idly touching the top button of her blouse.
"Might I inquire why?"
"Because this path was suggested to him, very strongly suggested to him, by Lieutenant Scarpa, who was the one who told him about the separate jurisdictions of the cities. Quite authoritatively, if I might say so."
As she'd said the lieutenant's name, Brunetti was reminded of a remark made by Creon. "Once an enemy, never a friend, even after death." But then Signorina Elettra smiled, and had they been standing in a field of flowers, the bees most surely would have come to sip honey from her lips.
"May I farther inquire where he obtained his information?"
Her smile broadened, and Brunetti was forced to turn away for fear of insolent shock.
"I'd heard him discussing the subject with the Vice Questore, and the lieutenant said he'd take it upon himself to find out what the territorial division was."
She paused and leaned to the side to flick a speck of invisibility from her desk.
"He was free, of course, to find this information for himself, but he told me to find it, and so I did."
"It was really made, this division of jurisdiction?" Brunetti asked.
"Of course," she answered. "In 1938.
After a long pause, Brunetti asked,
"And since then?"
"I've no idea, Commissario. The lieutenant told me to find any record of the administrative decision that separated the two cities, and that's what I found."
"And so, when all police oversight ceases, with the inevitable result, the lieutenant will be discovered to have cited the regulation from almost 100 years ago?"
"Precisely."
"Presumably this will not work to the lieutenant's advantage," Brunetti offered.
"I'm afraid not,"
she answered, with a smile that hinted at, but did not reveal, the size of her teeth. Brunetti stood for some time, so struck by her cunning as to be deprived of the power of coherent speech. Finally he freed himself from the spell and said,
"I'll be in my office."
She nodded and returned her attention to her computer. It was not until the afternoon that he saw Signorina Elettra again. She knocked on the door of his office about 5, and when she came in he saw that she carried some papers.
"The Three Musketeers?" he asked.
"Si, signore," she answered.
"Anything interesting?"
"Oh, I prefer you to make that judgment yourself, Commissario."
She came across the room and laid the papers on his desk. As she did, he said,
"Could you send copies to Commissario Grifoni and Ispettore Vianello?"
"Of course, signore,"
she said, and left him to consider the documents. There were 3 small piles of paper, each clipped together, the name Donato at the top of one, Gasparini another, Ruberti on the 3rd. He opened the first, and learned that Girolamo Donato had been born in Venice 63 years before. His family had owned and run the same pharmacy at San Leonardo for 3 generations. He had studied farmacia at the University of Padova and had gone to work in the family business when he was 25. During his career, he had once been elected the president of the Ordine dei Farmacisti della Provincia di Venezia. A son and daughter, both pharmacists, worked with him, as did 2 young women who helped with sales and the general upkeep of the shop and stock. The family lived in 3 separate apartments in a large building on the Fondamenta della Misericordia. His son and daughter-in-law had 2 sons, 5 and 3. His daughter, in her early 30s, was unmarried. Brunetti glanced up from the page, amazed that a family could be so apparently normal. They studied, worked, got married, had children, and worked. He glanced at the next page, which showed that Donato had given both his son and his daughter their apartments. After salaries, expenses, insurance, and taxes, the pharmacy earned approximately 150,000 euros a year. Brunetti was surprised at the sum, had thought it would be much greater. After all, a pharmacist worked far more than 8 hours a day, had to stay open on weekends and holidays according to a strict rota, which also demanded frequent all-night openings. He set the first report aside and looked at the papers about Gasparini. He, too, had been born in Venice, a bit more than a decade after Donato. He had studied economy and commerce at Ca' Foscari and started working in Treviso immediately after graduation. He had, in the course of 18 years of work, changed jobs 4 times. He had been at his current job in Verona for 3 years, and was now the assistant to the chief accountant. Brunetti went back and looked at the names of the companies for which he had worked and tried to understand what they might reveal about the possible nature of his job. Textiles, leather, all well and good. Holdings, enterprises, anything at all. Brunetti made a list of the cities where Gasparini had worked over the years, and saw that he had never remained in the same city for 2 successive jobs. He had moved from Treviso to Conegliano, to Padova, and then to Pordenone, and was now in Verona. Brunetti tried to imagine what it must have been like for them, both for their children and for the marriage, to uproot themselves and move to a new city, or to become one of the families in which the father makes his ghostly appearance after the children are in bed, only to leave before they are awake. As if Signorina Elettra had read his mind, farther information from the Ufficio Anagrafe followed in the next paragraph. During the previous 20 years, both Gasparini and his wife had maintained the same legal address, and the children had been in regular attendance at the Albertini for the last 4 years. Brunetti paged back and took a more careful look at the financial details of Gasparini's life. The salaries listed for each position he'd had were no more than average. If his wife were making the same salary as Paola, they could probably not afford to send their children to the Albertini. An explanation sprang unsummoned to Brunetti's mind. Fiscal misconduct of some sort, followed by dismissal. No sooner thought than discarded. Gasparini was unlikely to have managed that repeatedly without having been caught at it. Brunetti tried to think of some other reason for such a strange work history. Common, perhaps, in other countries, but not here, where many men stayed at the same job for decades, if not for their entire careers. What about blackmail? Who better than the accountant would know what the real finances of a company were? If officers of the Guardia di Finanza could be arrested for not reporting fiscal illegalities in return for money, how much easier for an accountant to plan and then profit from the same irregularities? The next page revealed that his 3rd company had, 2 months after Gasparini left his employ, been raided by the Guardia di Finanza, and its computers and records sequestered. It had taken the investigators very little time to discover parallel systems of bookkeeping that recorded the true, not only the purported, profits and losses of the company. Brunetti looked up from the page and all but saw it written. Work in a company long enough to discover if they were keeping a second set of books, or even devise the system that created them, then help keep those same books long enough to understand how the system worked, and then demand payment not to reveal it. If they paid, then take the money and change jobs. If they did not pay, find a new job and once there call the Guardia di Finanza. Of course, there could be some other explanation, but this one made sense, at least to someone with a professional inclination to treat all human behavior with suspicion and the presumption of guilt. He pulled the third pile towards him and started to read through it. Average student, medical diploma from the University of Padova in 1987, where Dottoressa Ruberti remained as an intern for 4 years, after which she joined two other doctors in a joint practice in Abano Terme. She left the practice after 6 years and returned to Venice to open her own private practice with offices in Dorsoduro and Castello. Married, divorced, one son with severe physical disabilities who lived in a facility for the handicapped. Never arrested, no driving infractions, owner of both her apartment and the ground floor space in Dorsoduro where her office was located. She rented the one in Castello. The report, sparse as it was, ended there. Chapter 27. Though it was late in the afternoon, he phoned both Grifoni and Vianello and asked them to come to his office, because he wanted to talk to them about the information they'd all received from Signorina Elettra. He leaned back in his chair and folded his arms, and studied the sky visible from his window, somber and sad and gray with the approach of bad weather. Life would retreat inside for months. The lack of sun would lead to grumpiness, and people would long to flee to the sun to go swimming or to the mountains to ski. He loathed skiing because, like polo, it required an enormous amount of equipment. Truth to tell, Brunetti loathed most sports, save for football, which his father had adored and taught him to love, and which had the redeeming virtue of requiring only a ball to kick around. Although he believed the sport was corrupt to its very core, millions made or lost by betting on games whose outcomes were preordained, he could not stop himself from being thrilled by those same preordained moves. He recalled a day when his father had taken him to see a game between Inter and... His brief reverie was broken by the arrival of Vianello, who came in without bothering to knock, and quickly after that, Grifoni, who walked in through the door Vianello had left open. They sat in front of him, each with a folder and pen, both obviously eager to hear what he had to say.
"I'd like to take a look at what Signorina Elettra found about the number of times Signor Gasparini changed jobs."
The other two pulled out their copies, and when they stopped turning pages, Brunetti asked,
"What do you make of the fact that he's changed jobs so often?"
Grifoni looked up, confused by the question, but Vianello said,
"It's unusual, isn't it, to move around like that?"
Brunetti nodded.
"I think it is, yes."
Grifoni glanced at Vianello but said nothing. With a vague gesture towards the folder, the inspector said,
"It could be that he's not a very good accountant."
It was audible to Brunetti that this was merely an introduction to what Vianello really wanted to say, which was,
"Or that he's indeed very good at it."
"Meaning?" Grifoni asked.
"Meaning that people don't change jobs so often, especially not in these times, and especially not a man who's married and has children."
Vianello paused to look at her.
"Not unless they have some reason to do so," he concluded.
confirming Brunetti's belief that Vianello, too, was aware of the dark corners of human possibility. Neither of them said anything, so Vianello asked,
"What about the visit of the Guardia di Finanza 3 months after he left the third place?"
He ruffled through the papers and gave the name of the company.
"Poseidon Leather."
"Two," Brunetti said.
"Excuse me?" he asked.
"It was 2 months."
Grifoni turned in her chair and asked Brunetti,
"Are you and Lorenzo jumping to a conclusion about this man that I don't see?"
Though the question was addressed to them both, Vianello chose to answer it.
"He didn't change only his job. He changed city each time. Do you have an explanation for why he'd be willing to disrupt his family's life so frequently?"
Vianello asked her in a voice that struck Brunetti as being more insistent than necessary.
"What needs explanation?"
Grifoni asked sharply.
"Why can't he simply have changed jobs a number of times?"
Then, glancing at Brunetti in order to include him, she added,
"You both seem to assume, with what I think is very little evidence, that he's up to something."
Brunetti and Vianello exchanged a look, which provoked Grifoni to say,
"Oh, stop it, both of you. Am I the goose girl of the village who can't see what the clever, experienced men can see with one glance?"
"Claudia," Brunetti said, "we aren't plotting anything. We're all looking at the same information."
"What does that mean?"
she asked.
"That we all read this," he began, holding up the folder, "and it seems we read it differently."
Grifoni gave him a cool look.
"And because two of you see it one way, that means you have to be right? If suspicion has company, it's suddenly the truth?"
"It might explain Gasparini's interest in the coupons. He might have seen them as an opportunity," Brunetti said, glancing at Vianello, who nodded in agreement. "If it happened that, as an accountant, he had to prepare the real books a company keeps, as well as the ones they show to the Guardia di Finanza, then he'd be in a position to make use of that information for his own purposes."
Brunetti looked at both of them. Neither had bothered to question his use of the phrase, "real books." Grifoni was busy examining the papers in her hands, as though trying to translate them into some other language.
"It would explain why he changed jobs," Brunetti continued, "and cities. Either he found that they were doing nothing illegal and left, or he found that they were and used his information to blackmail them and then left."
"Then why would the Guardia di Finanza raid the leather company?"
Grifoni asked.
Vianello suggested, "Because they refused to pay him and fired him. What better proof could he offer of what he could do to an employer if they refused to pay him?"
"Claudia," Brunetti began patiently, "I'm not trying to ram this down your throat. I'm merely asking you to consider it as a possible explanation for the way he kept changing jobs."
"How would he find another job?"
she asked.
"Especially if he's a blackmailer."
"They'd be eager to get rid of him, wouldn't they?"
Vianello asked.
"What better way to do that than by writing him a letter of recommendation, praising him so highly they could slough him off to some other company?"
"I think you're both crazy,"
Grifoni said abruptly. Both men stared at her, but Brunetti decided to attempt sweet reason.
"Oh, come on, Claudia," he said. "Just because we disagree with you?"
Leaving her no time to protest, he continued,
"The pharmacist is just another person for him to blackmail, like his former employers."
"I'm still waiting for evidence that it happened like that," she said.
Vianello interrupted to say,
"Let's talk about Dottor Donato for a moment."
He held up the sheaf of papers.
He seems like a decent, honest man who's worked hard all his life.
Both of them heard the sharp emphasis he put on the word seems.
He worked out this scam with the coupons, he went on. Signorina Elettra found the rules for pharmacists. They can add 33% to the cost of medicines, no more. But with cosmetics, they can ask whatever they want. She found one pharmacy with a 70% markup.
Brunetti looked at Grifoni and said, "Think about what it does to his profits to sell cosmetics instead of medicine." After a pause, he added, "Gasparini's an accountant. No matter how confused his aunt's story was, he'd see the advantage of the coupons in an instant." Vianello, in a far less combative tone, and careful to speak equally to Brunetti and Grifoni, added,
"Signora Gasparini had almost 1,000 euros in coupons. She's been accepting them for a long time, and so has her friend Signora Lamon. The person who profits from that is Donato."
This time Grifoni did not protest about what they said. Brunetti saw her abstracted gaze. He wondered whether she were trying to calculate Donato's added monthly earnings. Brunetti and Vianello shared a glance and lapsed into mutually agreed silence. Speaking slowly, as if begrudging every word, Grifoni said,
"All right. Donato would be better off if Gasparini didn't talk about this."
It was a long way from agreeing with them, but at least Grifoni was willing to accept the possibility. She went quiet again, and only after some time had elapsed, asked,
"Has either of you thought what would happen if you had Matilde Gasparini speak to a magistrate, or try to give a statement about what happened? Or what a good defense attorney would do to your parade of old women with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's?"
She held up her thumb, and then her other fingers, as she counted out her objections.
"You'll have only the testimony, if you can call it that, of these addled old women, or men. You have the coupons with Signora Gasparini's name on them, and her confused account of a 20% increase. You have no evidence of any connection between Gasparini and Donato. You have a colleague of Donato's who's repeated gossip about him. If you think this is enough to take to a magistrate, then good luck to you," she said.
Vianello looked sobered by what she said.
"We found no one else with a motive to attack him."
"No robbery," Brunetti reminded them. Silence returned. Brunetti saw that the sky had darkened, and night was fast upon them. He heard a sudden gust of wind, and across the canal leaves tumbled from the trees in the garden of the house with the fence. The wind banged the shutter of the last window on the right of the top floor back and forth, noisy witness to the increasing dilapidation of the building.
"So?"
Vianello finally asked.
"His wife would know," Grifoni said.
"You sound sure of that," Vianello said.
"Would your wife know?"
she shot right back. Vianello laughed. And the situation deflated.
"How dare you suggest that about Tullio?"
Professoressa Crosera shouted at them. She'd agreed to let them come to her home the following morning, had welcomed him and Grifoni with cool politeness. Brunetti had decided a third person would be too much, and Vianello had made no objection when asked not to go with them. The professoressa led them into the sitting room. Her husband, she explained in response to Brunetti's question, was a quiet, serious man whose life centered on his family and his— here she had paused and looked across at them nervously— passion for cycling. He'd competed in the Giro d'Italia when he was still a student, but realized that he lacked the stamina to be a professional. But still he rode, kept three bicycles in a garage in Mestre, and spent at least one of the days he was home at the weekend, in all weathers, riding long distances and returning home exhausted and tranquil. The thought of how normal this sounded made it difficult for Brunetti to go on to his next topic, his checkered work history. Nevertheless, he had, with some trepidation, asked why her husband had changed jobs so often, and she'd said, showing the first overt signs of irritation, that it sounded as though they suspected he'd been fired for some incompetence or irregularity at his work.
"That's what we'd like to exclude, Signora," Brunetti said seriously. "Not incompetence, Signora. Irregularity."
Brunetti had read, and often, that a person's mouth fell open in surprise. This is exactly what happened. And then Professoressa Crosera sat immobile for some seconds before she demanded,
"How dare you suggest that about Tullio?"
She seemed about to ask something else, but choked on her rage and had to stop, her hand to her mouth to stop her coughing, face red with fury. Griffoni, who had sat quietly through Brunetti's questioning, had winced with shame when he made his final suggestion. She sat immobile, face forward, not looking at either of them. Professoressa Crosera closed her eyes, and, in what in other circumstances would have been an act of conscious melodrama, placed a hand on her heart. Brunetti heard, for the first time, the ticking of a clock somewhere in the room. It ticked more than 100 times before Professoressa Crosera opened her eyes and looked at him.
"I will tell you this once, and then I want you to get out of my house, both of you. You will not speak to me again, and I will not speak to you, not unless I am ordered to do so by an officer of the court."
She hadn't bothered to look at Griffoni. She asked Brunetti,
"Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"My husband's parents died of cancer, 6 years apart. Their deaths were very ugly and very long. In each case,"
and here she paused and spoke with a tight-closed voice,
"his employers were so pleased with him that they gave him leave of absence and allowed him to work from Venice. And in both cases, he realized he could no longer do his work well enough, and so he resigned from the positions to take care of his parents, and we lived on my salary."
She looked at them to see that they were following her story.
"He did this because that's what seemed right for him to do, as did I. In the third case, he quit because the son of the owner asked him to do something illegal, and in the last, the company relocated to Shanghai, and he did not accept their offer to go and work there."
She looked back and forth between them. Brunetti met her glance, but Griffoni did not.
"And the Albertini?"
"Who pays for that?"
Brunetti asked, playing his last card, but playing it, he knew, badly.
"His aunt,"
she answered. This time her contempt palpable.
"So you can put to rest your idea that he was embezzling from his employers, or whatever it is you think him capable of doing."
She got to her feet and moved towards the door. Brunetti and Griffoni, each avoiding the other's glance, followed her. Professoressa Crosera closed the door after them. Brunetti explained all of this to Paola after dinner. She listened silently, sipping at the tisane they had decided to have instead of coffee and grappa. She sat on the sofa, her feet side by side on the floor in front of her, cup and saucer on her lap. Brunetti had chosen to sit in the chair opposite her and to drink from a mug.
"You didn't check with his employers first?"
she asked. Refusing to answer, Brunetti shook his head. After a time, Paola said,
"I'm sorry for Elisa."
"I wanted to tell you," Brunetti said. "She might be..."
"Yes, she might,"
Paula agreed.
I would.
Then, after a moment, she asked,
What did you do?
When?
After she threw you out.
I called Signorina Elettra and asked her to check on the dates of death of his parents, and then called the places where he was employed at the time to confirm what she said.
Paula's chin snapped up, and she stared at him.
You did this after not bothering to check at all before?
Paula asked.
Yes, Brunetti said.
Paula thought about this for a long time, but made no comment. Finally she asked,
And?
She was telling the truth.
Elisa usually does,
Paula permitted herself to say. And then,
Now what?
I want to speak to Dottor Donato.
What do you want from him?
I want to see how he reacts when I tell him Gasparini knew about the coupons.
Why tell him you know?
Because he'll realize we'd see the connection with the attack on Gasparini.
Have you considered that you might be as wrong about Donato as you were about Gasparini?
He's given the coupons to a number of people, so we're at least not wrong about that, he said, hearing how relieved he was to be able to see it.
That's considered small change in our world, Guido, she said, and waved it away with her hand. How much could he manage to make from them in a year?
Would it be easier to believe he did it if he'd made more? Would it be worse?
No, it wouldn't, Guido, though the law certainly has degrees of culpability.
You don't approve.
What he's doing is dishonest, tricking these old people into spending €100 a month on cosmetics, she said, allowing no compromise. Stealing and cheating have become so normal that we're ready to dismiss anything that seems to be a small crime as if it weren't wrong. Isn't there a law which says that if you're sentenced to 3 years or less, you don't have to bother to go to prison?
Brunetti nodded.
More or less.
She paused, but when he started to speak, she stopped him by saying,
Think of the Antigone you're reading. Who's right? Antigone? Creon? No one's hurt by what she does, so should she be allowed to break the law? She says she's obeying the law of the gods, doing what humanity knows is right. So can she break the law?
Brunetti didn't answer. He didn't have an answer, nor did the play. The play asked questions and asked the reader to consider them, answer them if they dared. Paula went on.
If she insisted on burying two brothers, three, would she be braver or more noble? Or for Creon, would her crime be two or three times worse?
Brunetti put his hands up to signify that he didn't know.
That's why people like novels,
Paula surprised him by saying.
In most novels, things get explained to them by a narrator. They get told why people did what they did. We're accustomed to that voice, telling us what to think.
You sound as though you don't like it, Brunetti said.
I don't. It's too easy. And in the end it's so unlike life, so fake.
Because?
Life doesn't have a narrator. It's full of lies and half-truths. So we never know anything for sure, not really. I like that.
So fiction really is fiction? Brunetti asked.
Paula looked across at him, open-mouthed in surprise. Then she put her head back and laughed until the tears came. Chapter 28 When he entered the Questura the following morning, the young officer at the door saluted him crisply and said,
Dottore, Signorina Elettra said she'd like to see you as soon as you came in.
He thanked her and started up toward Signorina Elettra's office, wondering what fresh information she'd managed to unearth since yesterday afternoon. He had slept badly, asking himself over and over how his suspicion about Gasparini, which he saw now had been based on nothing more than desperation to find a reason he had been attacked, had so easily spiraled out of control. Had Vianello's agreement spurred him on to behave so rashly? He'd read how much more aggressive men became when they were part of a group. Had he and Vianello become a group? Reluctantly, he conceded that their thoughts had formed a gang. The first thing he noticed was that the sober flowers in Signorina Elettra's office had been replaced by an immense bouquet of bold yellow ones. Zinnias? He never knew. They seemed pleased to be sitting in the light and looked as though they were planning to create some sort of commotion in the room. Signorina Elettra, he noticed as he approached her desk, gave off the same energy as did the color of the flowers. Her expression made it clear that trouble was brewing, but trouble for someone else.
"And what have you discovered, Signorina?"
The tone in which Brunetti asked the question was as good as a signature on a peace treaty.
"I saw Barbara last night," she answered.
"I hope she's well," Brunetti said.
He knew Signorina Elettra's sister and liked her.
"Very, thank you,"
she answered politely.
"I thought I'd ask her because she's a doctor and might know something."
"About Dottoressa Ruberti?" Brunetti asked.
"Proust,"
Signorina Elettra said and smiled.
"Barbara told me that's her nickname among the other doctors."
In the face of Brunetti's evident incomprehension, she added,
"Because she writes so much."
When she saw that he still did not understand, Signorina Elettra said,
"So many prescriptions."
"Of course, of course. For old people?" he asked.
"So long as they have Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, it seems," she specified. "She has a number of other, sometimes younger, patients who are depressed or bipolar. In both cases, she is said to have a predilection for prescribing new medicines and generally avoids the generics."
"Did your sister tell you this?"
"Of course not,"
Signorina Elettra said.
"All she told me was the nickname. I started having a look when I came in this morning."
Her face hardened, and she said,
"The health system never stops surprising me with the extent of its inattention. Its data bank is protected by a system that is an invitation to steal."
"Having a look?" Brunetti asked, choosing to ignore her indignation.
She gave the side of the keyboard an affectionate pat and said,
"I did the same as I did for Dottor Donato, commissario. I found her patient list and saw what she's prescribing."
She shook her head in feigned disapproval.
"Much of the medication is new."
"New, as in expensive?" Brunetti asked.
"Yes, and in some cases very."
"How does she get away with it?" he asked. "I thought the health service would at least keep an eye on what doctors prescribe."
"They do," she answered. "But her patient list is enormous, more than 1,000. So what she prescribes for other patients probably makes it balance out to some average cost per patient that the calculations of the health service will accept."
Her voice veered towards indignation again.
"They're very careless. It would take no time at all to flag something as conspicuous as what she's doing."
Before she went on to explain the details of this perfect system to him, Brunetti asked,
"Could you make me charts like the ones you made for the pharmacy?"
"Of course, dottore," she answered. "I've got a program that—"
she began, but anticipating his lack of interest, let it drop. She reached for a piece of paper and asked,
"What would you like me to list?"
"I'd like one with the people who are taking medicine for psychological problems, and one with the people with any form of dementia. Names, addresses, ages, what she's prescribed for them and its cost. In the cases where she's prescribed an expensive new drug,
give the cost of the generic or the standard medicine she chose not to prescribe. She looked up for long enough to smile.
Of course, Commissario.
She bent her head to continue writing.
Could you find out as well where the prescriptions were filled?
She nodded quickly to show the ease of this. The faintest memory of something he had read in the Gazzettino, some time, perhaps years ago, flitted through his mind.
Could you check to see if she's ever written prescriptions for people who are already dead?
She pulled her hand back so quickly that her pen left a black trail across the sheet of paper.
What?
It happens, he said calmly. At least the Gazzettino told me it happens. If people don't die in a hospital, the Ufficio Anagrafe sometimes isn't informed, or the health service. It can take months, even longer, before they're officially declared dead.
Signorina Elettra stared off into space, her face wrapped in the consideration of possibilities.
So they go to limbo and stay there, getting their pensions and having prescriptions written for them?
She shook her head a few times in a gesture that could as easily be admiration as astonishment.
Very tempting,
she whispered.
I'm particularly interested in which pharmacy fills their prescriptions, Brunetti said.
She gave a smile utterly deprived of mirth.
So am I.
She turned to face her computer, and it was evident that her attention had pulled up stakes and was moving off in the direction he had indicated. Realizing there was no further need for him to stay, Brunetti went back to his office. He had bought a copy of that day's Gazzettino on the way to the Questura, and he could think of no better way to while away the time waiting for Signorina Elettra to call. He knew she would think of nothing else until she had let herself into the information bank of the health system and helped herself to whatever she pleased. He set the newspaper on his desk and looked at the front page, which held a photo of the mayor, smiling broadly, posed in front of a map of the Canale Vittorio Emanuele, the city's latest attempt to keep the cruise ships coming at whatever cost to the citizens. Brunetti looked upon his works and despaired. At the bottom right was a small headline about the Carabinieri's dismantling of a drug ring in the city. See page 27. Page 27 told him that the Carabinieri, after a year-long investigation, yesterday had arrested 6 suspected dealers in an operation called Iron Fist. The sellers, it was revealed, had worked virtually unobserved near 3 of the city's schools, even in the face of complaints from nearby residents and the parents of the students in these schools. Finally, however, the dealers' time ran out, and an early morning raid by the Carabinieri led to the sequestration of 13 kilos of hashish, marijuana, and synthetic drugs and pills. All of the men arrested were in the country illegally. All were taken to the Carabinieri station, questioned, and released with an order to leave the country within 48 hours. Questions of jurisdiction neither concerned nor much interested Brunetti. Nor did he understand why people took drugs. It might be nothing more complex than that they were there for the having. Brunetti was pragmatic enough to approve of anything that interrupted the flow of drugs into young bodies. Beyond that, he took the short view. Maybe the pause in supply would help Sandro Gasparini. Maybe his father's situation would function as a slap on the back of the head and turn his mind to more serious things. Maybe not. Brunetti saw that there was a new pile of files in his inn tray, but ignored them and returned to the front page of the Gazzettino. As usual, he skipped over every article dealing with national politics, sighed at the international news, and ignored sports. That left him precious little, and he was quickly done with it. The options open to him seemed either to hurl himself from the window of his office or accept his responsibilities and read the files. He slid the newspaper to his left, then turned it over to hide the photo of the mayor, and pulled the stack of files towards him. Noon was ringing from the bells of San Giorgio dei Greci, when Signorina Elettra appeared at his door and knocked lightly on the jamb.
"May I come in, Commissario?"
Looking up from the file he was reading, Brunetti observed,
"Either I hear your news, Signorina, or I continue to read the discussion of how, in the absence of a city law regarding bicycles, to classify riding a bicycle in the city, whether as a crime or an infraction."
"I've read those directives carefully, Signore,"
she said with every semblance of seriousness.
"I think it's better to consider it an infraction."
Brunetti closed the file and placed it on top of the others that had already migrated to the left.
"Thank you, Signorina," he said. "And what do you bring me?"
"The chart, Signore."
"Ah, good," he said. "Is there anything I should pay special attention to?"
"No, Commissario. I think the numbers make it clear enough what's going on."
That said, she came across and set the papers in front of him, then left his office. Signorina Elettra had commented on how many patients Dottoressa Ruberti had, yet when he looked at the list headed dementia, he was still surprised to see that it consisted of 4 pages of patient names listed single-spaced, each name followed by the name and price of the medicines Dottoressa Ruberti had prescribed. There followed the name and price of similar, often generic, medicines that were also available. In some cases, the difference in price was triple, though it was usually a bit less than double. More than half of the prescriptions had been filled by the Farmacia della Fontana. In the second chart, Dottoressa Ruberti's patients with diseases of the psyche, also running to 4 pages, the same pattern was repeated, as was the name of the pharmacy. The medicines she prescribed for her patients were always much more expensive than the generic products listed beside them. The third chart, I Morti, introduced a bit of variety. The name of the patient was followed by the date of death registered in the Ufficio Anagrafe, and then by dates when each prescription had been filled posthumously. In some cases there were more than 2 years between the first date and the last. All but 6 of these prescriptions were still being filled by the Farmacia della Fontana. Brunetti found himself thinking of the chicken and the egg. Which would have come first? The suggestion from the doctor that the pharmacist pass on to the health service the cost of the prescription for the more expensive medicine and thus claim the higher refund? Or was it the pharmacist who went in search of accommodating doctors who would write the prescriptions the pharmacist could most profitably process? And which of them would offer, and which of them accept, whatever financial inducement was made? Brunetti realized he would have to speak to both of them to see what their truths were, but he had better begin with the temptee and not the tempter, if only because this weaker person would be more likely to tell the truth. It seemed to him more likely that the pharmacist would be the tempter. He turned on his computer and searched for Dottoressa Ruberti's address and office hours. She would be there today, he learned, in Campo Santa Margherita, not far from Signora Gasparini's home, until 1:30, which meant he could easily make his way there, take a seat in her waiting room, and then allow himself to become the last patient of the morning. For a moment he considered asking either Vianello or Grifoni to go with him, but he still felt sufficiently embarrassed about his complete misjudgment of Gasparini that he preferred to go alone. He got off the number 1 at Ca' Rezzonico and walked through Campo San Barnaba, past the fruit vendor's 2 boats, covered during lunchtime with green tarpaulins, over the bridge and down towards the campo. It was already after 1 when he got there. It took him a few minutes to find the address, just next to the estate agent. The sign gave her name and the hours of opening, and asked that the patient ring and enter. He did the first, heard the door click open, and did the second. He climbed to the first floor and saw another sign, with her name and an arrow pointing to the back of the building. At the end of the corridor was a door with her name on a brass plaque. He went in. Three people sat in the room, two women and a man. Four chairs were empty. Six eyes observed him as he entered and chose the chair farthest from them. Before he sat, he nodded at them, and, at their failure to respond, reached forward and took the magazine on the top of the pile on the table. The women, he had noted, were both very fat, and the man very thin. He had remarked nothing else about them, nor did he glance up to study them. Instead, he read Six Reasons to Become a Vegan, and waited. A door opened to the left of the three waiting people, and a woman's voice said,
"Signora Tassetto."
One of the women pushed herself to her feet, and, not without difficulty, walked to the door and inside. Brunetti observed the pale-skinned woman standing at the door. She was easily as tall as he was, wore a white lab coat. She turned away to follow the woman before Brunetti had time to study her. 15 minutes later, the woman emerged and made for the door, and the doctor called for Signor Cattucci. This time Brunetti noticed that the doctor wore no makeup and had light brown hair pinned back on both sides of her face. His eye caught hers. It was evident that she was surprised by the presence of an unknown man in her waiting room. She followed the patient into her office. Only 5 minutes passed before she came to the door again and allowed the man to leave. He walked slowly, as though he had just heard news he didn't like. There was no need to summon the woman, who had got to her feet as the door opened and passed in front of the doctor. Again her eyes went to Brunetti before she turned away from the room. It seemed a long time before the woman emerged, although it couldn't have been more than 10 minutes. When she had left, the woman in the white coat walked over to Brunetti and asked,
"May I help you, signore?"
Her voice was tentative, as though she were the person seeking help. She was in her 40s, he'd guess. Brunetti stood and set the magazine on the pile.
"I'd like to talk to you, dottoressa," he said.
"And you are?"
"Guido Brunetti," he said, and paused.
But then, still penitent over his treatment of Professoressa Crosera, he added,
"I'm a commissario of police."
She relaxed, but did not smile.
"Ah, yes,"
she said, stepping back from him.
"Come into my office. We can talk there."
She started to turn towards the other room, but stopped and said,
"I've been expecting you."
Then continued towards the door. Brunetti followed her inside. She closed the door and went to sit behind her desk, moving with an easy grace often seen in tall women. Her office was vastly different from that of Dottor Stampini at the hospital. Neat, orderly, with a comfortable chair for the patient at the end of the doctor's desk and an examining bed, covered with the usual sheet of paper against the far wall, in which there were two windows with a view to the building on the other side of the calle. A glass-fronted cabinet was filled with packages of medicine. Her desk had a computer on the right side. On the surface were two piles of what must have been patient files and nothing else. The usual medical diplomas were interspersed with photos of single flowers, enlarged to unrecognizability as anything other than exercises in construction. Brunetti sat in the single chair and looked at Dottoressa Ruberti. Her face was long, as was her body. Her thinness made her seem taller. Her glance was level, and did not shy away from his. Her eyes light brown, the sort of color that admirers would call amber, and detractors muddy. Brunetti had often felt uncomfortable in social situations.